Coming up, what U.S. experience with foreign aid says about the challenge of rebuilding Haiti.
Haitians need to be deciding their own destiny. They're going to have to solve the problem or it won't be solved.
Also, churches' attitudes toward teenagers who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. Some accept them, some do not. And Eastern Orthodox fasting during Lent.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. A long-anticipated meeting at the White House this week between President Obama and the Dalai Lama. Despite strong objections from the Chinese, the two spent more than an hour behind closed doors. The White House said they discussed human rights and pursuing dialogue between China and the Tibetans. The Dalai Lama told reporters Obama expressed strong support for preserving Tibet's unique cultural and religious identity. The White House meeting was private, but at the Library of Congress, the National Endowment for Democracy honored the exiled spiritual leader for his commitment to advancing human dignity. Meanwhile, as Christians around the world began observing the 40-day period of Lent, there was an extra measure of penance at the Vatican because of the ongoing clergy sex abuse scandal. Just before Ash Wednesday, Pope Benedict XVI hosted a crisis meeting with Irish bishops. The Irish Catholic Church has been rocked by revelations of decades of sex abuse by priests, which the church covered up. Irish church leaders said during this time of Lenten penance, quote, "We must begin with ourselves." 19 prominent Catholic scholars, many of them Americans, sent an unusual letter to Benedict this week, strongly urging him to slow down the sainthood process for the World War II-era Pope Pius XII. Many Jewish groups say Pius did not do enough to help Jews during the Holocaust. The Catholic scholars implored Benedict to be patient while more research is done into Pius's actions. 8 of the 10 American Christians detained in Haiti on child kidnapping charges are back home in the U.S. with their families. A Haitian judge released the 8 Baptists without bail after hearing testimony from parents who said they voluntarily gave their children to the Americans in hopes of getting them a better life. 2 of the group were kept in Port-au-Prince to answer more questions. The 10 were arrested on January 29th while trying to take 33 Haitian children out of the country. Now, a special report. The disaster in Haiti brought not only immediate emergency relief, it also triggered calls for new long-term development aid, rebuilding the country. Former President Bill Clinton saw a chance to build back better. The U.S. government has a long history of trying to help poor countries get out of poverty. Since the end of World War II, the U.S. has given or loaned 150 countries more than $1 trillion in civilian aid, not counting military assistance or the work of private charities and non-governmental organizations, many of them faith-based. We wondered what the lessons are in all this experience for, as they say, fixing Haiti. The good news is that in recent years, many of the world's poorest countries have seen an unprecedented amount of economic development. William Easterly is a professor of economics at New York University.
Hundreds of millions are escaping from abject poverty. In fact, we've seen the greatest reduction in poverty in our generation that has ever been seen in human history.
In overcoming hunger and disease and disasters, U.S. economic aid has saved millions of lives. But in the longer-term effort to help poor countries develop and remain better off, many experts say U.S. government aid has played only a minor role.
On balance, the sad news is it really hasn't worked. Most of the success stories did not get a lot of aid, And most of the countries that did get a lot of aid are not success stories.
For instance, in the 20 years before the earthquake, Haiti received $5 billion in all kinds of U.S. aid.
It's, you know, Exhibit A in the case that aid does lead to very disappointing results as far as, you know, actual reductions in poverty.
Even one of foreign aid's most loyal supporters has reservations. He is Lutheran pastor David Beckman, president of the Christian lobby Bread for the World.
I think our foreign assistance system is broken. It does some good. It does a lot of good. But we could get a lot more impact out of those tax dollars.
Well, if foreign aid didn't cause the world's great poverty reduction, what did?
Most of the progress that's been made against hunger, poverty, and disease has been made by people in poor countries working hard to serve their countries, to make their countries better.
In China, for instance, and India. So why didn't the U.S. foreign aid program get more for its money?
Corruption is it's a really disappointing story in aid, because a lot of aid did go to very corrupt governments, and it was frankly just stolen, and so it did not reach the poor.
It's not just the aid. Then it's a coordination of aid with trade and diplomatic policy. We charge Bangladesh more in tariffs for the things they import into the U.S. than we give them in aid. So we're taking away with one hand what we're given with the other.
In Washington, responsibility for foreign aid is spread over 12 departments, 25 agencies, and 60 offices, each with its own priorities.
Picture 60 different official aid agencies giving aid to agriculture in Malawi. And then the poor Malawian agriculture minister has to have meetings with all, you know, all 60 representatives of the aid agencies and prepare 60 different, you know, procurement forms to show that he's spending the money as they want him to. So that is a huge problem.
Meanwhile, many special interests here at home benefit from U.S. aid abroad.
Every dollar that we appropriate for food aid, more than 50 cents, goes to transportation and administration. It's partly because they're a small group of shipping companies. They're U.S. flag shipping companies, and the law says they get to ship that food. They are very well positioned to lobby Congress, and they push that all that money that's supposed to go help the poorest people in the world should go to food that they're going to ship. It's a scandal.
Andrew Natsios tried to change that. He's a former administrator of the Agency for International Development, now teaching at Georgetown University. Natsios wanted AID to be able to buy food abroad. That would help farmers in poor countries and permit quicker response to famine.
It's much faster. It's 4 months faster to buy food locally than it is to ship it.
And that could save lives. Natsios proposed buying locally to President Bush, but
we could not get it through Congress because the shippers and the maritime unions opposed it. The grain producers opposed, the grain processing plants opposed to it.
Last year, however, some local purchasing was approved. Professor Easterly has a long list of other reforms he would like, such as eliminating what he calls top-down development.
Top-down development is, you know, the official aid agencies decide what Haiti needs. They know the answers already. They don't need to ask the Haitians. The characteristic feature of the top-down approach is a plan, a grand plan to solve everything all at once. And of course, these plans work about as well as you know, the five-year plans did in the Soviet Union. The aid agencies really are not held accountable for results. All they're really held accountable for is just spending the aid money. We don't talk about how much of that did actually reach poor people.
Easterly also deplores a "we know best" attitude.
There's this awful problem of paternalism, that we, the rich Americans, know what is best for poor people in Afghanistan or poor people in Cameroon or Haiti. That, you know, really, that's an incredibly arrogant attitude, that we think we know how to solve other people's problems better than they do themselves.
Professor Natsios agrees with some of the criticism, but he strongly defends AID.
The United States does enormous good in the world, but Americans aren't aware of it. We can point to South Korea, we can point to Taiwan, we can point to Turkey, we can point to Greece, we can point to Costa Rica.
The formula is aid plus effective government and public policy make possible private investment and then trade, the essential key to development.
There's no real example of a country leaving the ranks of the poorest countries and becoming a middle-income country without an export-based strategy. So we know it works. In all of the Asian examples, it's all export-based. So it's very important. However, you cannot do it in the absence of aid. Trade is essential, but it's not trade or aid. It's trade and aid.
But what if a country such as Haiti doesn't have effective government and security?
An ineffective government that is not providing services to the population or is corrupt, a government that is not controlling the domestic crime problem, is allowing gangs to operate, these are all major problems.
Could the U.S. help?
Unfortunately, the record shows we really don't know much about how to fix governments from outside.
As the people of Haiti try to anticipate long-term development, Haitians there and in the U.S. recommend a new U.S. attitude. Ketlin Florestal is a Haitian and an economist at the Inter-American Development Bank in Washington.
We lost all our identity in a sense. I was talking to friends. Everything that reminded us of our childhood and our life is destroyed.
Nevertheless, she said,
we are very proud. We would like to define our future because we feel when we are getting assistance, our future somehow is sometimes being defined for us. I am definitely convinced that what's best for Haiti is not what is imposed to Haiti. I would call for everybody who wants to help to call on to the humility, a lot of humility.
I think we have to change our mindset from, you know, the idea of fixing Haiti to just the idea of doing as much as possible to help individual Haitians help themselves.
Yes, we need aid coordination. So if some agency is going to be set up to make sure that we don't trip over each other, that could be a good thing. But Haitians need to be in charge. Haitians need to be deciding their own destiny. They're going to have to solve the problem or it won't be solved.
The consensus we heard is that helping Haiti get out of poverty will be very difficult and will take a long time. But if Haitians lead the process, coordinated, respectful foreign aid might work. A new Washington Post ABC News poll shows Americans remain closely divided over whether same-sex marriage should be legal. 47% say yes, 50% no. But support for civil unions has gone up. Two-thirds of all Americans now say such unions should be allowed. Issues related to homosexuality have divided many congregations and denominations. We have a story today about the role of churches in supporting or condemning teenagers who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. Lucky Severson reports.
A personal moment of prayer for Joey Heath, a Master of Divinity student at Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. There was a time it seemed very unlikely he would be where he is today, a time when he was praying for God to make him whole. Make him so he wasn't gay.
At the time, I believed that it was something I needed to be healed from. And so I would pray every day that God would just heal me of this evil part of me and that this would be just removed and I would be cleansed and made whole again.
Today, Joey says he feels whole, but he's still gay. And he's still facing the kind of condemnation he faced in his United Methodist Church when he first came out.
I was involved somewhat in the leadership of the campus ministry, and then my campus minister said I could no longer speak on behalf of the ministry because it would be an endorsement of my lifestyle, which for me was devastating.
Pastor Heidi Newmark says that condemnation has led to outright discrimination. She says too many churches have created an environment where it's okay to bash gays or lesbians or bisexuals or transgenders, known collectively as LGBTs.
Churches have played a huge role, probably the largest role, in fostering homophobia. And the church encourages these young people to be viewed as less than human, dehumanized, and even demonized. And it creates an atmosphere where it's okay to be verbally abusive, be physically abusive. So these young people, many of them suffer profoundly, physically, psychically, spiritually. You want to try over there? Haiti.
During the day, Pastor Newmark runs a school for young children at her New York City church, which is part of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. At night, she operates a shelter for LGBT kids because she says since churches have been a big part of the problem, they should be part of the solution. Jonathan Sawyer, who sleeps in a church basement every night, represents an alarming statistic. Nationwide, 20-30% of homeless kids are LGBT. In New York City, it is 1 in 3, according to Zach Rittenhouse, who works in a homeless shelter for gay and straight youths.
Here in New York City, 7,000 kids identify as gay or lesbian, and they're on the streets for various reasons, and there's definitely some religious ties to that.
Zach is gay. He grew up in a Baptist church where he says he was taught that being gay was sick and an abomination. He says many kids who come out are forced out of the house by parents who accepted that doctrine from their churches.
The parents don't know how to react when their kids come out, so they push them out on the streets. The kids don't feel safe at home, so they run away.
Matt Gromlich went to a private Christian school and says what he had been taught in church made it traumatic when he discovered he was gay.
At some churches that I visited, there'd be messages about how homosexuality is wrong, or they'd throw it in with a list of sins. And, you know, I wouldn't really say anything but just not go back. In that time, I was really struggling with faith and being gay. You know, and well, if I accept that I am gay, which I had at that point, then how can I still be Christian?
The church says these things where, you know, if you don't change, you're going to hell. And people get to a point where they feel like, well, I can't change, so I guess there's no hope. And so they abandon the church.
If I came to you and said, Pastor, I'm gay, what would you say to me?
I would say that's against the creative order of God. It violates the way God has set it up. And so while I understand that you have that attraction and that it developed maybe by no fault of your own, you're not free to act upon that.
Bob Perdue is pastor of the Old Dominion Baptist Church in Bristol, Virginia. Like many other Christians, he believes the Bible makes it clear that living a gay lifestyle is a sin. But he doesn't believe it's any worse than any other sins.
A lot of times the church will quote Leviticus 18:22 and say, you know, man lying with man is an abomination. What we forget is that Proverbs also says pride and lying and gossip are also abominations to God.
Nor does he believe, like many Christian conservatives, that being gay or lesbian is a choice. But he does believe that acting on an attraction to the opposite sex is a choice and a sin to God. When Zach Rittenhouse came out, his parents sent him to a 6-week camp that promised to make him interested in women.
They had told us all that by the end of this 6 weeks, we'd all be heterosexual men and women walking in the light of the Lord.
He says of the 80 kids who went to camp, to his knowledge, none came out straight.
Raise up an army, O God.
Though there are no reliable statistics on whether these ex-gay ministries actually work, many, including Pastor Newmark, think it is cruel to try to force change on these young people.
There's members of the congregation here who have been in therapy to try and get them to stop being gay. I haven't talked with anybody that's worked for. I think that's abusive.
Pastor Perdue says both he and the church are there to help heal those who are broken, whether it's sex, pornography, gambling.
I would first ask you why you considered yourself gay, and I would expand that identity to include other parts of who you are and hopefully get you to see that you're so much more than just that sexual attraction. You know, just like an alcoholic, I do the same thing with them.
Like an alcoholic, says Perdue, homosexuals need to learn how to control their yearning so they can, in his words, experience life to the fullest. The pastor knows of what he speaks.
I was sexually abused at 10 or 11, and those were my first sexual memories. So I developed an attraction, a same-sex attraction, which obviously at first my first response to that was to suppress it. And then the kind of the guilt and shame of all of that led me to a suicide attempt.
After 30 days in a psychiatric hospital, Pastor Perdue says he came to terms with his sexual proclivity. He's now married and the father of five children.
I can't say that my attraction has completely changed. I liken it to my fellow ministers who are married. Their attraction for other women hasn't gone away, but they're choosing not to act on that attraction because they've made a vow and a commitment in a certain direction. It's the same for me.
There are a number of denominations that accept practicing gay ministers, and Pastor Newmark says as more young people come out and homosexuality becomes better accepted by society, ever more churches will have to eventually teach tolerance, even if they believe the lifestyle is sinful.
What really makes me angry is that is to know that that church people, because I love the church, I am a pastor of a church, have a real hand in creating so much pain.
Pastor Perdue agrees the position of many churches against homosexuality has been harmful, but says he doesn't know many other pastors who share his view.
They haven't walked where I've walked. They haven't been where I've been. While I haven't changed my theology on what homosexuality is, that I have definitely changed my attitude toward people who struggle.
After Joey Heath completes his theological education, he hopes to be ordained a pastor.
I feel called by God to minister to those that have been pushed out and neglected by the church. And the church, to a certain point, has created a class of people that are not worthy of church. And I want to go to those people.
But before he can go to those people, he needs to be ordained. And the United Methodist Church, his church, does not as yet ordain self-avowed practicing homosexuals. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Washington.
On our calendar, this Sunday, the first Sunday of Lent, Eastern Orthodox Christians celebrate what they call the Triumph of Orthodoxy, when in the 9th century, icons were officially restored to the liturgy after a lengthy ban. For both Eastern and Western Christians, Lent is a time of prayer and fasting. In the Orthodox tradition, the fasts are especially strict. Jack Hinton of the Russian Orthodox Cathedral of St. John the Baptist in Washington, D.C., talked with us about fasting during Great Lent.
In general, the purpose of fasting is preparation for an important event that takes place at the end of the fast. And this is true not only of Great Lent, but of the other fasting periods as well. The very cause of the fall of man was an act of disobedient eating. Fasting is voluntary, but it's expected unless you're physically unable to. What I hope to achieve is weakening myself physically so that it's easier for me to remember that I depend for my very existence and for my daily sustenance on my Creator. I want to de-emphasize the day-to-day material world, and I want to emphasize spirituality. There's a strict fast, which means abstain from everything for obviously short periods of time. And this applies to the preparation for every Holy Communion. The basic fast is abstain from meat, and meat includes fish with backbone, dairy products, animal byproducts, oil, and wine. It affects my daily life, there's no question. When you reduce the amount of food you're eating and your blood sugar drops and you become a little bit lightheaded, you are very much prone to lower concentration.
There is a spiritual and a physical dimension to the fast. It doesn't do you any good to not have the kinds of foods that are prohibited and forego the period of introspection and deep contemplation of your own spiritual state.
Theosis is what happens to those who run the earthly course successfully and are given their salvation at the end of this life. fasting plays a role in theosis. It's the process by which we are perfected and made divine. We all become little anointed ones, little Christs.
And finally, which state has the most frequent churchgoers? According to a new Gallup poll, it's Mississippi, where 63% of people say they attend church weekly or almost every week. And the least frequent? They're in Vermont, where only 23% say they regularly go to church. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. We'd like to hear from you. You can follow us on our Facebook page. We also have much more on our website, including more of my interviews about foreign development aid. You can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from Tibet as local Buddhists prayed for and celebrated President Obama's meeting with the Dalai Lama.